You are listening to Galaxy Industry Radio. I'm Morgan, and this is Peter Decking, the show about stuff that interests me. Tonight, I have with me Big Brother, BSV, and Sard. Yeah. And aren't you guys glad that the it's only the Q output through TeamSpeak that sounds like shit, that the recording and the broadcasting sounds pretty good? But, I mean, my God, that's actually one of the things why I got so upset when you guys told me you did a live show through TeamSpeak of music. It's like, wait, what?
It didn't sound that terrible, actually. I don't know.
I've done a lot of work to try to tune the server, so I'm sure it did okay. It's just like,
yeah.
Music over, no. So, now, never minding the other vents or the other, I don't even want to go to it. Don't even want to go into that. So, I am currently drinking some Johnny Walker Black Label to hopefully suppress my dry cough and, of course, get trashed. What are you guys drinking?
Devil's Cut.
Good call. Good call. What'd you say, Sard?
Shock Top.
Ah. Yeah, I like that Devil's Cut big. That's, I mean, hey, careful, it'll sneak up on you, but that's,
oh, yeah.
I like that stuff. BSV?
Nothing for me.
Oh, we're going to have to start instituting a new rule. You know, Pure Decking has a 2-drink minimum. So, let's see.
Fine, I'll be right back.
He's really going to get something. Yeah, awesome.
It's like a dress code, man. You show up without wearing that sports jacket, dude, we throw your ass out on the curb.
That's what, you know... I never really intended the alcohol consumption to be an integral part of the show, but it's kind of become that.
I was just going to say, too late.
Well, it's sort of like the tagline on Galaxy 15. We support the robot Joe pricing was a joke. And if you want to know where that came from, Google the Galaxy 15 satellite and what happened to it a couple of years ago. It's actually where we got the name at the station. I was drunk when I registered it. And the freaking tagline stuck to this day.
Well, like I said, man, this is the internet. What you say here lives on forever.
I kept thinking, yeah, we'll think of something better eventually, and it stuck. So, anyways, I'm really just stalling until BSV gets back. But, there we go. What'd you get, BSV?
I don't have any hard alcohol, but I have Nerd East.
Yeah, that'll work.
It's beer.
It's beer. Actually, my homebrew isn't quite done yet. I'm going to be able to put that stuff in the fridge probably Sunday.
What kind did
Maybe
you make
Saturday.
This time?
It's Oktoberfest, but I got a couple of different flavor extracts. So I've got 3 of them with a bourbon extract in them. So I'm hoping I get like a bourbon barrel
cool.
flavor
did
out
you
of
make,
them.
Did you try the chocolate one yet, or is that one of the ones that's coming?
It's one of the ones that's coming. I've got a couple of bottles with a chocolate extract in. That's either going to be really
I'm
good or
sorry.
Terrible.
Yeah, that still sounds awful. You'll have to tell me how that is. But
well, I'm hoping to get a little bit of. I'm hoping the chocolate flavor won't be that overwhelming. I'm actually just wanting to get a little bit of a sweet taste in it. You know what I mean?
Right. So, good luck. That's all I got to say.
And I'm actually watching the chat room this time. Yeah, Cycros, you're right. It's a darker beer. But it's not a stout, so we're just it's an experiment. We're trying it, which is why it didn't go in all of them. We're just putting a couple of the bottles to see if see how it comes out. And if you know, I did 2. That way, if it comes out good, you know, hey. If not, I only wasted 2. So, anyways, though, moving on into go ahead and get into our discussion. I found a story today. It's on The Verge. And
I figured this would be a good jumping point. A landmark document created at the request of NATO has proposed a set of rules for how international cyber warfare, should be conducted. Written by 20 experts, because they found 20, in conjunction with the International Committee of the Red Cross and the U.S. Cyber Command, the Tallinn Manual on the International Law Applicable to Cyber Warfare analyzes the rules of conventional war and applies them to state-sponsored cyber attacks. Unsurprisingly, the manual advises that attacks must avoid targets such as hospitals, blah, 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 blah. They go in here talking about we leave citizens alone. Where's the actual part we cared about? According to the manual's authors, it is acceptable to retaliate against cyber attacks with traditional weapons in a, when a state can prove the attack will lead to death or can prove the attack will lead to death or severe property damage. It also says hackers who, that didn't copy and paste in correctly. Only use force when you reach the level of armed conflict. So, yeah. It's, essentially what they're doing is saying if you're engaging in cyber warfare, which means, you know, you broke into somebody's Facebook account, they can shoot you in the head.
Wow.
I mean, it's seriously, as poorly or loosely defined as the term cyber warfare is, if you put on the Guy Fawkes mask and you know, pop a forum somewhere, does that mean the Marines can show up and, you know, shoot you?
That's an interesting statement. I don't know, man.
So wait, is this going to lead out to all-out war with China?
I don't know. Probably. I mean, that's essentially what this says, isn't it? That, look, if you're doing cyber warfare on us, we can bomb you. I'm sorry, but even when you're messing with people's financials, there's almost no, you know, hacking attacks that are actually going to kill anybody. I mean, maybe if you get into a hospital and screw with the pharmaceutical dispensers, or if you find a really, really crappy HVAC system that's hooked up to the internet that you can, I don't know, get to overheat and explode, which
they probably
that'd
aren't
be
talking
a pretty
about
crummy
that. I mean,
system.
You could, you know, hurt and harm some people if, say, a power plant went offline. People have no power, they start freaking out. It's the same way, you know, people die in summer because of heat stroke. It's like you cut out their AC, they don't know what to do, they're old, they can't get move around or something. So it's not like you aren't directly harming them, but you're indirectly causing them harm.
That's still pretty loose for the whole we're sending in the Marines or the drones. I mean, that's the real question, isn't it? You know, as crazy as they've been with the drone program, it's like, are they just going to drone your house if you're, you know, popping somebody's MySpace account?
Right.
Big made a good point of mentioning China. I do think a lot of attacks are coming from China, but I don't think they're originating there. China doesn't give a crap about our intellectual property laws. So a lot of people are running pirated software out there, and most of it is pre-infected for you. Like, if you go download a pirate version of Windows, it's probably got a bot or two in it already, because it's an easy way for them to build a botnet, right?
Sure.
So I'm sure a lot of those attacks, whereas they might look like they're coming from China, they're probably coming from, you know, the States, Russia, who knows, you know what I mean?
But, are you arguing that China is just the big scapegoat in this whole cyber warfare and everyone's
yes.
just bouncing
I mean,
through
yes.
proxy?
Does China have state-sponsored hacking? Absolutely. So does everybody right. else. But they are like the number one boogeyman right now. At work, I convinced my boss not to put the China article in because it's like, we can do better. He sent out a newsletter and it's like, no, let's not do the let's find something better. Come on. That was like his fallback position because he found it in 5 minutes. So
what are the stipulations on this? Does it say countries or people?
It doesn't. It just says
that's scary.
You know, cyber attacks.
Because you could argue that, you know, hacking into my Facebook account damages my personal well-being, and then that's a cyber attack, and then just,
What am I going to do? Harass you on Facebook till you kill yourself?
Hasn't that happened?
Yeah, well, isn't it defacement or whatever? Or defamation of character type thing? They could argue that.
So, I guess to really get at the crux of it, it's... The term cyber warfare is bullshit. It's something made up by people who don't know shit for shit about computers so they can put it into something they understand. I mean, you know, it's, they make it out like you can just order a hack. It's like, go hack their satellite system and take it down. It doesn't work that way. When you're doing, you know, any kind of network attacks or malicious activity, it's all about opportunity. I mean, sure, most stuff is open as hell and easy to break into, but... You know, it's still all about the attack of opportunity, right? I mean, if it's set up right, you're not getting into it. Or, you know, it's not going to be immediate. I mean, it's like going to be a long-term thing where you got to figure out, you know, how do I get somebody to plug a flash drive in? That kind of thing.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just blowing this a little out of proportion, but this story bothered me because they're treating kids knocking each other off IRC as seriously as, you know, somebody with a gun trying to take your land.
Yeah,
like fighting over borders and shit like that, you know?
Right. There's definitely some severity differences there.
I mean, it's not quite Ghost in the Shell yet where you can actually kill somebody by hacking into their brain. I'm sorry. Now, when that happens, you know, absolutely we can talk about it, but that's not the case yet. Can you ruin somebody financially? Absolutely. Can you cause all kinds of headaches for sysadmins? Sure. Could you even knock out critical infrastructure, things people need? Probably. But, I mean, it doesn't... I guess I don't see... I mean, even if you got into a power station and knocked out the power plant... Does that actually warrant a response with B-52s?
Well, no, that's why they have drones.
Well, thank you, Big. You know damn
well. Yeah.
Well, I think if you're stupid enough to put critical systems for a power plant on the internet, they should send the drones to you.
Absolutely.
That's very true.
If your system's that wide open and that poorly designed, that's... I mean, yeah, whoever's doing the attack has some liability, sure. But, I mean, you know, putting a little piece of, you know, putting a little note on the switch, do not touch, and then putting the switch in the middle where, you know, in the middle of a street and hoping people leave it alone. I don't know. The term cyber warfare bugs me. I really don't like it because it's not warfare. It's not.
Well, the way it sounds, they want to make it warfare. You know, the hacking is just a pretext for regular war. Which, you know, as we know, America needs more war.
Yeah, sure we do. I don't like the term. It's always bugged me because what you're taking is either something that organized crime does. A lot of botnets are organized crime. Or individuals, usually they do it. There is some personal gain, but it's mostly just harassment. I mean, it's not even. I mean, yeah, you can break some systems, but you know, if they're properly set up, they're not that hard to fix. If you're defacing a website, oh wah! Most of the time, you're just that's equivalent of defacing a billboard for the company. That's what most websites are. If you're taking out an online store. Or making it so like a payment processor can't do work, like, you know, if they're DDoSing Visa or PayPal or something, it's loss of business. But I just don't see it on that same level as actual warfare. I really don't. I mean, warfare is about breaking stuff and killing people. Hacking is occasionally breaking stuff, But usually it's more about, you know, making people, you know, redirecting their browser to Meatspin or stealing their credit card than it is actually killing anyone.
That's true. But like I said, if you go back to the infrastructure piece about it, what's another component of war? It's also depriving the enemy of their much needed food, supplies, you know, bullets, comforts, and could, you know, taking out a power plant via the internet, couldn't that be seen as the same way? I mean, you're essentially crippling or trying to disable the enemy over the internet. Yeah, you weren't blowing it up, but what if you severely cripple it somehow to where it's irrecoverable? You know, now that army that's sitting in that town doesn't have power for whatever they need, their communications or something.
Shouldn't that fall under other laws, though? You are damaging the equipment, whether or not it's over or the internet, or if you went to the power station and with a baseball bat and started smashing panels.
You've got a really good point there, BSV. Except if somebody in how do you prosecute somebody in China for vandalism?
Well, in China they would probably shoot them. But that's China.
You're assuming they would bother to prosecute them for an American crime at all.
Yeah.
Actually, you're right. They probably would shoot them, but that's just for population control. It's like, hey, it was a good excuse.
So what happens? How long will it take for someone to say, hey, you know what would be funny? Let's pretend we're China and fuck up with the U.S. government.
Oh, that was kind of my point earlier. I'm sure that's already happening.
With botnets, who are they going to go after? The people that have their computers taken over, or the people controlling it?
People who don't know any better? I mean, command and control channels aren't actually that hard to find, but sometimes it can be really hard as to figure out who's directing them.
Hmm.
What are you trying to say, Big? You got stepped on a couple of times, sir.
Well, what I was trying to say is, what if some jackass, let's say a member of Anonymous, decides he's going to pretend to be China and do something to the U.S. government, one of their websites, Deface it or whatever, and say, China did this for China! Under this law, wouldn't we start attacking China? Under this false pretense, they didn't do anything.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. That's part of my problem with this kind of thinking. It just doesn't seem to me to warrant that kind of response. And it is, it's extraordinarily easy to make it look like it's coming from somewhere else. So, I mean, how, with attribution being that difficult, I don't want them firing a missile based on where they think the attack's coming from. I mean, how many times have you seen your GPS on your phone get it wrong? And that thing's with a radio designed to figure out where you are, let alone trying to hit an attacker's system, you know, from an IP address. You seriously, go look into any of the geolocating IP address things. There's lots of websites that'll do it. You give it an IP address, it'll tell you where in the world it thinks it is. It usually narrows it down to a city. Punch in your own and see if it's right or not. If you're not in a major area, it's probably not. It's probably going to point to wherever the ISP's tie-in is. So it'll, you know, mine doesn't say it comes out of where I live. It says it's coming out of Nashville, even though Nashville is actually pretty far away from here. So, but yeah. I'm just, you know, unless you're targeting a really big bomb, I have problems with this. I really do. And, you know, if it's a system that's that critical to the infrastructure, like, you know, if something knocks out this power plant, maybe you shouldn't have those systems on the internet in the first place. Just a thought.
Yeah, but we've heard that. You can't use that as an excuse, right? I mean, haven't we heard that before? Oh, well, you know, because they didn't secure their wireless, I was able to hop on it and download whatever I wanted. Oh, look, now the RIAA is on your doorstep. You can't use that as an excuse.
RIAA wasn't there kicking in your door and shooting at you.
Boy, God, they want to.
Yes, but...
Oh, shit, right.
Gladly, they can't yet.
So, I don't know where I'm going with this. I just... This whole idea of responding to a quote-unquote cyber attack, which, like I said, I don't even like the term, with actual weaponry. I mean, okay, if somebody's being dumb on the network, you walk over, smack them in the back of the head and say, quit it. I mean, okay, that's one thing. But... I mean, actually, like, you know, sending in the troops because they hacked your bank account. I've got a problem with the concept. I really do. And I'm not sure that I'm explaining it very well. I mean, the response doesn't seem to fit the crime. You know what I mean?
No, it really doesn't.
I agree with that. I don't know. It just depends. It's another one of those things, I think. It depends.
Yeah. All right, so... Let's go ahead and move on to some stories here. Current events, as I call them in my carefully worded show notes. The first one up is from H Online. Andrew Arenheimer? I'm not intending to mispronounce his name. I'm just not sure.
Andrew.
Now, Andrew, also known as Weave, has been sentenced in a U.S. court to 41 months in prison and 3 years supervision. In August 2012, he was convicted of accessing the email addresses of 120,000 iPad users along with an AT&T or through an AT&T site, amounting to one count of identity fraud and one count of conspiracy. Andrew was potentially facing 5 years in prison for each charge. The site in question had been created to simplify logging into an AT&T service with the 3G-enabled iPad by allowing it to look up a connecting device and match it to an email address. Andrew and his accomplice, Daniel Bittler, created an automated script to extract all the email addresses. Bittler accepted a plea bargain, taking 12 to 18 months prison time in exchange for information about his and Andrew's activities, and the unexecuted plans to exploit the information for nefarious purposes. I thought he was bragging that he pulled it off and published all this stuff. Anyways, the data was eventually handed over to the Gawker News website with the aim of publicly embarrassing AT&T. Andrew and Spiller have also have to pay AT&T via the U.S. Treasury $73,000 restitution. Andrew has 10 days to appeal the sentence. So we've hit the story a couple of times on Decking that this guy found a flaw in AT&T's website and was able to exploit it and pull people's email addresses. And AT&T sued the crap out of this guy and got him prosecuted. Now, the way he went about publishing his exploit was childish. You know, he was, you know, bragging about hacking them and laughing and lording over them, sending it to Gawker. But he didn't really break into anything. He just figured out how to punch data into their script on their web server and get a response. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure on this one because the guy was apparently acting like a douchebag with it. But I mean,
does that really warrant 41 months at jail?
Well, 41 months of jail and $73,000. I mean, that's right. A lot of money. For essentially dumping people's email addresses.
Yeah. No, I agree. So, I mean, that's definitely one of those cases. I think a lot of these that keep coming up is the punishment is way more enormous than what actually occurred, what the crime was.
Yeah. Go ahead, BC.
So it was just the email addresses and not the... any passwords or anything?
No passwords. I think they did get the identifying number for the iPad they had, too. It was like a serial number for the iPad and the email address it was associated with. Something like that. It's been a while since I read the original story. But it's just like, wow, 41 months in prison and $73,000. That's for email addresses, essentially.
Yeah, that's definitely disproportionate.
So I think people are just still terrified of computers, and so anything with them true. They don't understand, they just go nuts.
Well, just like with the previous story, it's probably it's people that make laws are old and don't understand the technology and are like, oh my god, it's a computer, they can blow up my house with the touch of a key, you know?
Well, it's not even old. I mean, my grandmother does fine. She's got an Android tablet and does all kinds of crazy stuff. So, I mean, I'm not going to chalk it up to old. I'm just going to say disconnected from reality, people who have no clue about this stuff.
Oh, yeah, exactly. People that are unfamiliar with it, I guess. It's just a stereotype of
being old or not. Well, yeah. No, most of them are old. I mean, it's fair. It's just not because they're old. It's because they're morons. All right, next one up is from the BBC. The Institute for Prospective Technological Studies examined the online habits of 16,000 Europeans. They also found that freely streamed music provided a small boost to sales figures. The International Federation of Phonographic Industry, the IFPI, said that the research was flawed and misleading. Well, of course they did. It seems that the majority of music that is consumed illegally by the individuals in our sample would not have been purchased if illegal downloading websites were not available to them. Wrote the researchers in their report. Digital music consumption on the internet, evidence from Clickstream data. So what they're saying there is, you know, yeah, they may have downloaded it, but if it wasn't free, they probably just wouldn't have got it at all. They would have just ignored it. Although there is trespassing of private property rights, copyrights, there is unlikely to be much harm done on digital music revenues, they added. The team analyzed data over the course of 1 year. They also found that music streaming services such as Spotify and Pandora gave a small boost to music sales. According to our results, a 10% increase in clicks on legal streaming websites led to a 0.7% increase in clicks on legal digital purchase websites, claimed the report. However, the International Music Industry Body, the IFPI, was highly critical of the research. The findings seem disconnected from commercial reality, they said in a statement. Our sales are down, so you're wrong. If a large portion of illegal downloaders do not buy any music and yet consume in some cases large amounts of it, and it cannot be logical that illegal behavior stimulates legal download sales and inflicts no harm. Okay, they misunderstood the report. What the report was saying was, for the most part, the streaming services was exposing people to new music and they were more likely to buy more music. And the people pirating probably wouldn't have bought it anyways. So it wasn't actually hurting sales. And, you know, of course, the IFPI was like, no, illegal stuff doesn't boost sales. Which I don't think that's what the report was saying at all.
What? Being able to listen to the stuff for free before you buy it doesn't make you interested in it?
Well, it's kind of the problem with getting a movie ticket, right? You know, you don't know what you're getting when you pay for it. So one of the reasons they really don't like streaming sites and pirating of movies is, you know,
they can sell you junk without letting you know it.
Right. So, you know, they'll get that first week of sales until word gets around that movie's terrible, don't go see it, and probably, you know, make a ton of money on it. Whereas if people can see a chunk of it online and then go see it, you know, make the decision to go see it, they might just go, well, that movie's shit, and just skip it. So it's the same problem. It's like, well, you know, if the only way to listen to music is to buy it first, what if it's an artist you don't know anything about? Well, you just got to buy it on blind faith, don't you? So it sounds to me like Spotify and Pandora are serving the same service traditional radio serves.
That's a good point. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I've been using Spotify recently, and I love it. I found a bunch of new bands, and I'm looking to get some of their stuff. But the thing is, I also did the same thing with pirating, simply because it's so awkward to finally meet a band and say, I downloaded all your shit. Yeah. Can I still get your autograph on this hard drive?
Now you at least get a burnt copy.
Yeah, can you sign the CDR for me?
Yeah. The Pirate Bay
remix. Can you sign
remix?
My MP3 player? let's see. BSV, you were going to try to say something?
I was just adding to the joke.
Sorry, I think Sard was.
I was just going to bring up the point that's... trying to buy something on blind faith like that is part of my mind with the old model. Everyone now, with the advent of the internet, wants to try everything before they buy it. And that's one of the arguments that pro-pirating people use is they say, you know, hey, I downloaded this, I wanted to listen to it, I liked it, and then I went and bought it. And I think that's part of the new modeling system, and once again, they're just holding on to the old way of people blindly going out there and buying their material, and oh yeah, this does suck, don't buy it, but you know, they already have their money, so who, I don't know, it's just they're holding on to that dying marketing model.
Well, it's the same reason they go after the resellers and the secondary, you know, the used CD stores and shit like that. They try to make it really hard for those people to operate. Video games do it too. This is the same reason. You know, they don't make any money on the secondary sales, so they don't want you to do it. They want everyone to buy new copies.
Exactly.
If the NPAA was... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to bring up Cycrus in the chat said, imagine if car dealers didn't let you test drive cars before buying them. Would people buy a car? You spend, you know, $30,000 on blind faith?
Oh, you'd probably have to. Actually, that's a good point. At one point in my life, I decided I wanted a PT Cruiser. I thought I would really like a car until I drove one. And it's like, nope. No response to that? Really, guys?
Well, no, it's true. It's the same thing. Like, how do I know I'm going to like this music? Maybe I like one song on this music. Or, I mean, one track on this CD. Is that really worth the $20 that it costs to buy the CD?
Oh, yeah, I've done that. You know, you hear one or two tracks, you really like it, you buy it, and then every other track on the thing is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've definitely been there. So, let's move on to another fun story. This one's from Wired. President Barack Obama's administration is claiming that authorities do not need court warrants to affix GPS devices to vehicles to monitor their every move. The administration maintains that position despite the Supreme Court's infamous decision last year that concluded with attaching the GPS devices a matter to search protected by the Constitution. The administration is set to make its argument Tuesday before a federal appeals court in a case testing the parameters of the High Court's 2012 decision. If the government prevails, the High Court's ruling would be virtually meaningless. This case is the government's primary hope that it does not need a judge's approval to affix a GPS device to a car. Catherine Crump, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, said in a telephone interview. Crump will square off Tuesday with the Obama administration before the third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. The question of whether probable cause warrants issued by a judge are needed is an open one because the High Court stopped short of answering it. The court ruled in January 2012 that attaching the device amounted to a constitutionally protected search because it was a trespass on a private vehicle. Even so, the decision's aftermath, the government disabled 3,000 GPS trackers it had installed in vehicles without warrants. So, just as a point, you might get out and get under your car and see if there's any little boxes under there you don't recognize, because I'll bet they'll go for money on eBay. Actually, you know what? On that advice, look for things that actually look like they're not part of the car. Just because you don't recognize what that part is, if it looks like it's part of the engine, you probably don't want to rip it off and put it on eBay. Just
I bet you still get a lot of money for it, depending.
It's like, yeah, I took this box off the bottom of my car and the car won't start now and all this oil went everywhere. No, not that part. I'm at the part under the bumper that looks like a project box, Radio Shack project box or something. Among other things, the government is arguing that the Supreme Court has given the police broad exemptions to obtaining search warrants, such as with the oversight of school students and probationers, the maintenance at the border, and even searching vehicles and luggage for drugs. That exception should apply to GPS devices, the government said. In court papers, the authorities also told the Third Circuit that demanding warrants could even hinder terrorism cases. Requiring a warrant and probable cause before officers may attach a GPS device to a vehicle, which is inherently mobile and may no longer be at the location observed when the warrant is obtained, would seriously impede the government's ability to investigate drug trafficking, terrorism, and other crimes. Law enforcement officers could not use GPS devices to gather information to establish probable cause, which is often the most productive use of such devices. To establish probable cause, Wow. Thus, the balancing of law enforcement interests with the minimally intrusive nature of GPS installation and monitoring makes clear that a showing of reasonable suspicion suffices to permit the use of a slap-on device like that used in this case. So, how much more of this story is there? Yeah, the case concerns some brothers. They apparently hid a GPS device under the bumper without a warrant, and that's what caught it. So, yeah, the government is arguing again that no, we don't need a warrant to know where you are at all times. Nothing?
You know, didn't that happen a few years ago on Reddit? Some guy was messing around with his car.
Oh, yeah, no, he pulled it off and sold it, and yeah, they got pissed at him.
Well, didn't they, like, force him to give it back, I thought?
Yeah, like they did. They claimed it was government property, like, and he didn't have the right to keep it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was on his property.
Yeah, too bad, slave.
But my question is that they're complaining about it. Well, if they have enough evidence that they really need to track the car, should it really... I doubt it would take that long to get a court approval nowadays,
It's the warrant process is fairly streamlined. I mean, I'm pretty sure you call the judge up and say, we think he's a drug dealer. Can we put a GPS on there? He'll probably say, okay. I mean... it's just me. It doesn't seem like it'd be that big of an inconvenience to get a warrant. And if it is, wow, that's really says something about the level of our police work.
No, it's just inconvenient to get evidence. They don't want to bother with getting evidence. Why should that hinder them?
I said, Fergus, I think you're right.
I don't have time for that shit. I got policing to do.
After Big saying that, saying, don't tase me, bro, seems like an appropriate to...
Don't tase me, bro! Don't tase me!
Let's see. I lost my place. Next story up. This one's from H Online. A previously unknown hacker has undertaken a census of the web. To perform his internet census 2012, he infected about 420,000 poorly protected embedded devices with what he described as a harmless bot named Karna. Poorly protected in this case meant either no login credentials were required or standard credentials such as root or admin were able to gain entry. So all those routers with really bad passwords or printers with no passwords? Yeah, that's what he used. In response to inquiries by the H's associates at Heist Security, the hacker was not willing to divulge any information about his identity. CNET states that Gordon Lydon, Fyodor, the author of the network scanning tool Nmap, is behind the census. However, this... they're saying Fyodor did it. may be due to a misunderstanding. Nmap was used for the census, but there's no evidence that Fyodor himself was behind the legally dubious project. It is legally dubious because the perpetrator uploaded between 46 kilobytes and 60 kilobytes, depending on the processor architecture, of botnet software onto the third-party devices without obtaining the owner's prior consent. I can see why they get confused. Fyodor has scanned the network before, but he did it straight up just from his machine, because he was on another podcast I listened to and was talking about how his ISP got pissed at him for it. So I doubt it was actually Fyodor. This enabled the hacker to accelerate the scanning speed by a significant factor. In response to his inquiries, the hacker confirmed that he did not obtain legal advice prior to carrying out his census. The unknown hacker has packaged the results of the census into some fascinating graphics. Suave actually sent me one of the stories with the pictures in it. Everybody's got these pictures all over the place. He recorded every IP address, which responded to one of his 52 billion pings sent between June and October of 2012. A total of 420 million IP addresses and devices responded to ping requests. That's a lot of people who don't know how to turn off ICMP. But it's another result from the census which is most interesting. The number of poorly secured devices connected to the internet. The hacker states that he did not sniff around the intranets of which infected devices were members. In response to high security inquiries, he writes that it would have been easy to add functionality for infiltrating intranets into the bot code. He underlined his efforts were to ensure that his bots did not cause any damage by noting that the scan was set to be performed with the lowest possible priority and that his binaries were removed from the devices when they were reset. While the census was being undertaken, however, surrounding bots ensured that the bot code was reinstalled.
Nice.
Nice. As well as the bot binary, the hacker also placed a README file on infected devices explaining the purpose of the project and providing an email address for inquiries. The designated email address received only two messages, both of which from honeypot operators who had been affected by the bot.
Nice.
This is awesome. I mean, so a lot of people have really badly secured stuff, so this guy took advantage of it to make a nice map of the internet. And people shit a brick. Actually, you got to go check out some of these Internet Census 2012 pictures that have been put together from his data sets.
They're
some of them are really
sweet, man.
Yeah, really nice looking.
Really? I think I have a new desktop background. These things are sweet.
Uh-huh. It's too bad it's not being updated in real time. I'd like write a little script to pull down whatever the current...
Cool. Every day.
So, I mean, but looking at it, it's really obvious where all the internet users are. It's like it's even easier to tell like where people don't live. Like if you notice, like there's almost no dots in Cuba. There's almost nothing in northern Canada, but right along the Canadian border, you know, where people actually live, all kinds of dots. There was another really interesting spot on one of these maps.
What's really interesting to me is all the random dots throughout the ocean. You know, those small little islands?
Yeah. Might be ships or oil platforms or something.
Yeah,
maybe not the ones way out in the ocean, but... No, there was... it was Korea on there. It was one of the interesting ones because it was really obvious everything was in the southern part of Korea, not the northern part. And I can't find the spot on the map I was looking at earlier. But, yeah,
I see the one internet cafe in North Korea.
Right along the southern border.
Yeah.
No, it's actually in the middle. Either that or that's the deal leader's
internet. Oh, I see it now. There's two of them.
Yeah, it was really funny. I'm not finding the spot on the map, and I'm not going to sit there and dig on it for too long. But, it, I mean, it makes it really obvious where internet is and where it isn't. And, you know, it kind of makes you wonder when people talk about the technological divide, how, you know, how right they really are. So, especially when you see, like, large parts of China and, like, most of Africa. Good chunk of South America, just, like, no internet whatsoever.
They have a lot of issues besides internet connectivity.
True, but you kind of wonder how many of those issues could be helped by, you know, ready access to information. So...
kind of funny. Look at Russia, dude.
Yeah, well, I think that's because most of Russia is, you know, Siberia, and nobody wants to be there.
Yeah, yeah. But there, you can definitely tell. I assume that's where Moscow is. There's this like bright orange dot.
Yeah. I think that's what it is. So let's see. Let's go on to the next story here. This is a long one, so I'm probably gonna skip parts of it. It's from CNET. AT&T, Verizon Wireless, and Sprint, and other wireless providers would be required to capture and store Americans' confidential text messages, according to a proposal that will be presented to the congressional panel. It was presented on March 19th. The law enforcement proposal would require wireless providers to record and store customers' SMS messages, a controversial idea akin to requiring them to surreptitiously record audio of their customers' phone calls, in case police decide to obtain them at some point in the future. Billions of texts are sent every day, and some surely contain some key evidence about criminal activity. Richard Littlehill from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation will tell Congress, according to a copy of his prepared remarks. In some cases, this means that critical evidence is lost. Text messaging often plays a big role in investigations related to domestic violence, stalking, menacing, drug trafficking, and weapons trafficking. Little Hill's recommendations echo a recommendation that a constellation of law enforcement groups, including the Major Cities Chief Police Association, the National District Attorneys Association, and the National Sheriffs Association, made to Congress in December, which was first reported by CNET. They had asked that an SMS retention requirement be glued onto any new law designed to take to update the 1986 Electronic Communications Privacy Act for the cloud computing era. God, they had to slip cloud computing in, did they? Really? A move that would complicate debate over such a measure and erode support for it among civil libertarians and the technology firms lobbying for a rewrite. So I'm going to skip a bit here. Wireless providers' current SMS retention policies vary. An internal Justice Department document that the ACLU obtained through the Freedom of Information Act shows that as of 2010, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint did not store the content of text messages. Verizon did for 5 days, a change from its earlier no logs at all position, and Virgin Mobile kept them for 90 days. The carriers generally kept metadata, such as the phone numbers associated with the text, for 90 days to 18 months. AT&T was an outlier, keeping it for as long as 7 years. There was another interesting paragraph in here. Okay. Littlehill also proposed that any attempt to update the ECPA include revised emergency language that would allow police to demand records from providers without search warrants in some cases. So what's going on here is they're trying to mandate that cell phone providers store SMS messages because they could contain vital evidence. You apply that same principle to a lot of other things, and you quickly figure out why it's a dumb idea. A lot of times when you see these special laws for technology, if you just find another thing to apply them to and see if they would work, you quickly figure out why it's a bad idea. Like, yeah, we're going to require that's a good example. We're going to require your garbage company to keep your garbage stored in sealed bags and labeled for 60 days or 90 days just in case you threw away something we think is important. We want to be able to go to the garbage company and tell them to, we need that person's trash for X amount of time. It doesn't work. If you haven't noticed, the garbage company just throws everybody's trash together, then burns it or crushes it or buries it or whatever they do with it. So when you try to apply that same principle to SMS messages, oh, well, they could be sending something that's evidence. Well, yeah, they could be doing a lot of things. It's sort of like saying, well, the file sharing programs, they could be used to exchange copyrighted information. So therefore, we have to, monitor all of it. I mean, it's stupid. It's short-sighted law that's written to make – it's written because the police don't want to do police work. They just want to be able to subpoena and call it a day.
Yeah. Also, person them to or companies to do more work of actually having the storage of all the stuff.
Oh, absolutely! If that thing gets passed by stock and hard drive companies,
yeah, it's like it's the similar to the garbage. More closer one is since you have video cam or security cameras up, we're now mandating you keep records for the last 2 years just in case we figure have a case that happened something around here.
That's a good analogy, BSV. It's a better one than mine.
You know, I've got a crazy idea, and this might just work. So they want to capture and record everything because you might say a keyword, right? So they're looking for keywords through all these text messages. Why not start filling up your text message with nothing but keywords, like dirty bombs?
Just make their database useless.
Oh, yeah. Everyone listening, just start doing that. Text dirty bomb to everybody you love.
Yes, I'm sure they want to actually look at it, but I'm thinking this is more of them just forcing them to hold on to it in case you show up in a criminal action, they can then make sure you still have it so they can look at it with a subpoena or a search warrant.
Well, then my idea will either help you or hurt you quite a lot.
Either way, right?
He said nothing but dirty bob for 3 months.
I don't get it.
Turns out he was actually asking for somebody to help him out with his laundry problems. So let's skip the Cisco story. That's obvious and probably going to be covered a lot of other places. And I'm just kind of looking at the clock here. So next one up is from Torrent Freak. After the popular BitTorrent tracker Demonoid suffered a DDoS attack and hacker attack July of last year, the site's servers in the Ukraine were pulled offline. Local authorities explained that Interpol asked them to take the action as part of an investigation of the site's alleged owners in Mexico. An arrested Demonoid admin has since been released and the case has been stalled, but the BitTorrent tracker remains offline. With more than half of a year of downtime, Demonoid has already broken the previous record it set in 2007 and 8. But with a reputation as a comeback kid, many of the site's former users haven't lost hope that one day it will return. I don't know, the last couple of times it went down and came back up, I kind of thought it was like a honeypot.
Yeah.
But so I seem to remember telling people I didn't trust the return of Demonoid. So this also leads to some seeing to see things. Wait a minute. This also leads some to see things that aren't there. Over the past weeks, Torrent Freak has received dozens of tips about a new Demonoid that is believed to have thousands of daily visitors. The site in question, Demonoid.mk, uses the Demonoid logo and favicon, which leads some to believe that this may indeed be a legit successor. However, Demonoid.mk is nothing like the old Demonoid. The new site functions as a meta search engine, and unlike the real thing, is not a semi-private tracker where users can upload content. So this is the new Demonoid is nothing more than one of those aggregators that shows up. Like if you ever Google search for like a torrent, as opposed to just going straight to a torrent site, that the aggregators that show up that try to show you ads, that's what the new Demonoid is. There are absolutely no signs that there is a connection between the two other than the name and the logo. Those who look closer will see the new site isn't very original either, to say the least. It's built using the fairly popular Torrentify X script, through which anybody can easily set up their own torrent search engine in a few clicks. There are hundreds of other sites that use the same script, with several carrying the names of popular sites. The PirateBay.mk, Heat.im, BTJunkie.mk, ISOHunt.me, ISOHunt.mk, blah, 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 blah. Let's skip all these, just to name a few. We don't know who's behind the Demonoid.mk, but the site appears to be operated by the same people who run several of the other .mk torrent search engines. All the sites use the same Google Analytics code.
Nice.
That's a good way to see who owns it. Just check the Google Analytics code. I like it. I hadn't really thought about that one before. The Pirate Bay version appears to be the most popular, with tens of thousands of visitors a day, which is not bad for a cheap script. The bottom line is, however, that the sites are simply trading on the names of popular torrent sites to get more traffic. Those waiting for the real Demonoid to return will have to wait a little longer.
Yeah, guess who just made a freaking shit ton of ad revenue?
Yeah,
by using that name.
I know.
Good idea. Why didn't we think of that?
That is exactly what they did. And I mean, I just thought it was hilarious because Demonoid, you know, keeps going away and coming back. So, but
you know, if for the same reason, I kind of don't trust the new Pirate Bay. I haven't trusted Pirate Bay for a while.
I don't use torrents much anymore. I really don't. I usually go to file lockers. They're less likely to get you caught. Not that I even pirate that much anymore. Mostly I'm using open source stuff or Creative Commons stuff, so usually when I go to the file lockers searching for something, it's some little one-off I'm wanting to play with, so it's actually pretty rare. I guess that's why I'm able to get away with it. Now that I think about it, let's see. Last story I've got for tonight. This one's from H Online. In his presentation at the Black Hat Europe Security Conference, Andy Davis from the UK-based NCC group explained how he turned a Dell docking station for a Latitude E series into a data spy that is difficult to detect. Apparently, the top part of the docking housing provides enough empty space to add various extra hardware components. The core component is a Raspberry Pi-based controller that only weighs 45 grams. Excuse me. The controller is hooked up to the docking station's various interfaces, Ethernet, VGA, USB, audio, and combined with a 3G, 4G stick and flash memory. The SpyPi controller, okay, really, SpyPi, will use mobile networks to transmit the harvested data, and it can also receive remote instructions this way. Davis said that all the important interfaces are accessible from the inside, and that a few solder points are all that is required to tap into the ports. Two potential approaches are conceivable in terms of the network interface, either passive sniffing via an Ethernet switch or an active connection that involves inserting a tiny Ethernet hub into the docking station. The hacker said that the second approach offers the advantage that it will also allows attackers to inject data into the networks and infiltrate the intranet. Davis noted that the disadvantage of using a hub is that it adds extra MAC addresses that may raise suspicion when the switches are monitored. The researcher continued explaining that the Ethernet switch has the disadvantage that encrypted data traffic can be recorded but not decrypted. Also, the switch isn't capable of transferring data and data rates excess of 100 megabit, which could potentially be detected when the network is monitored. Display contents are recorded via the Video G host component that is available from outlets such as Amazon. The breakout cable will pass through the image signal and create screenshots and store them in the integrated flash memory. Any integrated notebook webcam can also be misused. Two pins of the USB controller in the docking station's motherboard are responsible for the upstream USB signal. The hacker soldered two small cables to the pins and connected them to the Raspberry Pi. Andy Davis said that it would be difficult to detect a modified malicious docking station. Methods such as regular weighing to detect modifications to weight deviations or thermal imaging to detect controllers are far likely too far involved, he added. The expert recommends securing docking stations with a lock and using anti-tamper seals or stickers. I just thought this was hilarious. This guy figured out how to put a Raspberry in a docking station and just steal all the data going through it.
Yeah, man, that's badass. Like, this is kind of goes along with the Digital Dojo that's coming up. But how come we don't see more of this kind of stuff in the news? Do we just think that they aren't, you know, getting seen? Or I would think like Dropboxes are kind of the way of hacking of the future type thing, because computers are so cheap. The Raspberry Pi is $35 or whatever, $25 for the cheap version. I'm just kind of surprised that we haven't seen these like even on the news yet.
Well, you haven't needed them before.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
still
always
just because everything's connected to the internet. We're going through that way, or?
Well, I mean, $25 is still nothing compared to somebody else paying for their laptop, right? Like, if I can root your laptop and then use that as a pivot point in the network, why should I buy something and then risk trying to get it installed by, you know, breaking into the place at night or sneaking in there in the day and hiding it behind a potted plant, right?
Oh, I guess that's true. Yeah.
So, that's actually a conversation I was hoping to get into in, you know, when we do. Oh, I screwed up the timing. I tried to do a transition.
Me love you long time.
Dropboxes. I really tried to swerve the conversation there and screwed it up. So. But yeah, obviously for Digital Dojo, I wanted to talk about leaving machines on people's networks, because you can get some really cheap computers now. I mean, really cheap. And, you know, if you lose them, well, you're out some time and, you know, the $50 or whatever it was to put the thing together, which, depending on what you get out of the network, that might be worth it. So, to talk about Dropboxes, the first link I've got in Digital Dojo goes to an Iron Geek article where he describes how to turn the Raspberry Pi into something he calls a SCART. It's a Norwegian, or,
Svartcast?
Svartcast, yeah, that sounds good, Svartcast. and the little slug from his article is, the first obvious question is, where the hell is a Slarkcast? It's a term he picked up from Telecomics. He would just refer to it as a Dropbox, or a Kamikaze box, or a Black Throw, which I always liked, Black Throw. And apparently Slarkfast is the English, or is the Swedish word for Black Throw. The core idea is to have a cheap host you can leave on somebody else's network that you can remote into, but that can't easily be tied back to you. And he's got an article describing how to set up a Raspberry Pi so that it uses I2P and SSH to set up a tunnel out that you can remote into and pivot off of inside of a network. And the idea is that a Raspberry Pi is cheap, so you might lose it, you might not get it back. If it gets caught, you know, you're okay not getting it back. his article is really good. He's got really good instructions on how to do this. And at that point, then it's just your imagination of what are you going to throw through this proxy onto somebody's network, right? And depending on how well you hide the Raspi on somebody's network, I mean, I don't know if you've seen these things or not. They're tiny, like a couple of credit cards tiny. So you could get creative with a case and hide it in like a bottom of a potted plant or a stuffed animal or just with a piece of duct tape in the bottom of a chair.
Why does my plant have an Ethernet cable running out of it? Does anyone know?
That, it lets you, it tweets when you need to water it.
Oh, perfect. I love it.
I mean, you know, it's and it'd be really easy because the Raspberry Pi has GPIO pins to actually set up a potted plant that will tweet when it needs watered. And by the way, does a bunch of other crap. So, I mean, it'd be really easy to take this SmartCast idea and add a little something onto it so that you've got an easy explanation for why you're leaving a potted plant with an Ethernet port on the side of it on somebody's network. Maybe the potted plant's not the greatest of ideas, but I mean, you know, like a lamp where somebody could, you know, hit a web interface and change the color of the RGB LED. That'd be really easy to do with the GPIO pins on this thing. Not to mention, with the GPIO pins, you could put like a photoresistor on it. So like it knows when the lights have been turned off in the room, so that at that point you can safely assume that they've gone home for the night.
Right.
So you can start going nuts on the network. What else could you do? You can do all kinds of stuff with GPIO pins. It's just how creative you want to get. So... hell, hook a TV be gone up to it and screw around with their TV during the day, whatever. So anyway, so this Iron Geek article is outstanding. He goes into really good detail of you know, starting off with one of the Linux builds for the Raspi and adding ITP and how to set up the SSH tunnel so that you can just go drop it on a network and connect to it over ITP and bounce off of it. Now, his is pretty specific to the Raspi, but I'd be willing to bet if you had like an old cell phone on Android or one of those Android on a computer or Android on a stick mini computers, you could probably apply the same setup fairly easily, fairly cheaply. And again, they're tiny, so easy enough to hide in something. Plus, if you use an old cell phone, it's got a battery and probably Wi-Fi.
Right.
So, you know, there's lots of little devices you could probably apply the same concept to and just be a little bit of work to figure out how to get I2P on them and then follow his SSH config. So another good device for doing this is called the Mini Pwner. I think I've talked about that on Decking before. It's the same concept, except instead of using a Raspi or an Android stick, it actually uses a TP-Link router, one of those little tiny travel routers. They're pretty cheap.
They're used in pirate boxes.
Yeah, a lot of people use them for pirate boxes. You stick a 2 gig SD card in it or whatever. You use the Mini Pwner, and the Mini Pwner OS image with it, and you've got something very similar to the SlarkCast. And I mean, it'd probably be nothing to turn the thing in. You know, use the I2P setup and do the exact same trick. So. You know, it's just a little box, and at that point, it's just how do you want to get it on somebody's network and disguise it? Hell, if you're willing to do the Wi-Fi thing, really, all you got to find is a power feed for the damn thing, and you know, hide it as a USB toy that lights up or something. I don't know. So, you know, at that point, it's just a question of your creativity. So, you know, how do you defend against something like this? Because these things are tiny. I mean, depending, you know, if somebody's willing to duct tape it under a desk, you may never find it. Or worse, you know, think about somebody opening up like a desktop tower case and just grabbing a power line and powering the thing up and, you know, maybe doing something with the Ethernet port like they were talking about in the docking station, or, you know, putting a little Wi-Fi card in it and positioning it so it can actually get signal through the computer case, especially if it's a mostly plastic computer case. So, yeah. I mean, how would you find that? I mean, physically, how would you find it?
Pure luck, or you'd have to be watching your network and seeing, oh, there's this new device that has a new IP address, and it looks kind of like a weird MAC address. You know, we have all Dell computers. Why is this different MAC address suddenly on our network? It's not a printer. Yeah. And then, you know, at the, but that requires someone to be watching.
Yeah, you actually have to watch your logs.
Yep.
Watch your DHCP logs, or maybe run something like a registered MAC addresses or a NAC.
Yep.
And I mean, that's a pain in the ass, but.
Well, depending on the size. I mean, if you're a small business or something, and you know you have 5 devices on your network, and suddenly you have 6, it would be pretty easy to distinguish that. But I mean, if you're have a big ass network, you know, class A, class B, or something, you're most likely are not gonna notice something like that unless you have someone always watching.
Or, you know, think about this. What about someplace like a Starbucks or another bookstore that has like a, not a hell, McDonald's, someplace with a, you know, public Wi-Fi? You set one of these up, give it a power line, duct tape it under a table, and leave. Well, it's got an ITP out, so you know where it's going to be. At that point, you've got a little bounce box. Good luck ever figuring out where that thing is.
Yeah, that's true. The only thing about that is typically, at least you would hope that their public wireless would be segregated off of their internal network. So really, well, sure, you'd only have access to the other nodes on that network,
or the internet.
That's true.
So you could use it as a bounce point to go attack somebody else, and then when they try to figure it back, it's like, well, Starbucks is attacking us. Great. It's like, well, Starbucks is attacking us at hours they're normally closed. What the fuck? I mean, so that's certainly a concept with these things. Actually, I was, other than like getting into a company, like pretending, you know, setting up like a job interview and going in and dropping off one of these things or something, or, you know, I had any other number of ways to get, you know, just walk in and asking to use the bathroom and hiding the damn thing in the ceiling, right? But, you know, the public Wi-Fi was the place I thought would be fun to leave one of these things, you know, duct tape it under a chair, run it a power cord, or even better, if you could hide one inside like a power strip and then leave the power strip there so it looks like it's supposed to be there because people will freaking use it, right? It's like, oh no, don't get rid of that power strip. People use that. You know what I mean? Go plug a printer or something into it so people leave it alone.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, besides public Wi-Fi and, you know, like businesses that you're actually actively trying to hack, I don't know, where else do you guys think would leaving one of these things would be useful? Maybe like a school's network, like a university or something, someplace with a nice high-speed connection that you can use to bounce through.
Sure, anywhere where you need a proxy, essentially.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, can you guys think of anywhere else it'd be fun to leave one of these things?
You could actually just get one of those Walwart Linux servers with Wi-Fi in it. Though. Yeah, but still. It might be easier to hide it than a bare PC, bare PCB like that.
True. True. I mean, it that's a question of creativity, though.
Yeah.
Right. And case can be made real easily and put it.
I wonder how hard it would be to rig up something so that it looked like a novelty or a toy, so that you could leave it in a parking lot and somebody'd go plug it in to see what it is, and it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's a lamp, you know, whatever. Mail it to them like, you know, you've been selected as a trial for this, you know, USB toy. I mean,
USB missile launcher.
Like, you know, we're Trend Micro and trying to get your business. So here, we've sent you a USB missile. I don't know. You know, fake product promotion or whatever.
I got a different question. I'm not really familiar with I2P. Is that a protocol where it's like reverse tunneling? It goes out and it's connects to a predetermined... Oh, turn to Tor?
It's like a Tor.
Huh, okay.
So it's good reading. Go read up on ITP. It's an interesting layout because they use a sort of a meshed onion system as well, but nodes get a kind of a crypto ID to them. I mean, it's really hard to figure out what that ID, you know, unless you've got the endpoint right there, it's really hard to figure out the endpoint is, you know, that ID. So you can generally get it a system across ITP, even if you don't know what its IP is going to be. So, there's some interesting stuff with ITP. It's definitely worth looking into. The other, when we were talking about mitigations, obviously the device monitoring tried to track how many machines you have in your network. The other thing I thought of when I was trying to think of how I would defend against these things is host hardening. You know, it's like, well, try to set up your network so it doesn't matter if you get a bad guy inside the network, and that'll actually help you with things like viruses and botnets too. But it can be really tough to do.
Really tough, especially if you're a big organization.
Yeah, and you have things like, you know, it's really hard to get some of these things pushed through. It's like, no, we ought to do ACLs so that you can only talk to the machines your machine needs to talk to, and that's a really hard sell. It's really hard to manage. Another good thing to do is do some egress monitoring. Watch what connections are coming out of your network. It's like, why is this oddball connection going from an IP I don't recognize inside my network to some cable modem out in Timbuktu? That's strange. Or why do I see this SSH connection from some server in China to, you know, I mean.
That would, I think, would be a little more noticeable, especially if you're a U.S.-based company and you don't do business overseas. So why the hell would we have a connection to China? To the cable modem, though, I mean, if it's a local cable modem to you, you know, maybe it's a user that's remoting in their home or something like that. You know, so that I think that goes back to, again, how big is the network? How many people do you have watching those connections?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Once you get past, you know, like 10 machines, it can be really rough trying to do that egress monitoring. But let's say you force everyone to go through a proxy server or something. You can start logging the oddball stuff. So, but again, that comes down to network design. It's a little bit beyond what I was wanting to hit in the Digital Dojo segment. So, I don't know. Anybody else have anything on Dropboxes before I close it out and we finish up the show here? I'll take that as a no. So listen to the stream. We're always working on it, and we're always looking for new music to add. Big's been looking for new music to add. Sart's been messing with the stream rotation. And, again, we might have some downtime. You know, I think I meant to talk about the beginning of the show and never did. I'm going to be working on the back end a little bit. I'm going to be adding – I'm actually going to be messing with the liquid soap setup we tried to use before. I'm going to try to hook that into SAM so we can do some more advanced programming. And that's going to open up some options for like backup sources and stuff like that. So if our main broadcast box is down, the secondary can take over, stuff like that. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. Nameless Review 7. BSV, when are you doing that?
Hopefully next Monday, if nothing goes wrong on that day again.
Yeah. Big, is you're doing Shoot the Noise next Wednesday, or is that every other week now, or how are you doing that?
Hopefully, I hope to get back in a regular schedule soon. School has really kicked my ass this semester, so I don't know when it's going to go back to a regular schedule.
Understood. So, of course, check out the Galaxy 15 Radio site. If you want to have some fun, galaxy15radio.com/America. I was goofing around. And, of course, the Galaxy 15 Radio Twitter handle, the feedback forum, and the subreddit, and the IRC channel, and any other, you know, if you can throw telepathic messages around, I'd rather you didn't, because that would really disturb the hell out of me, getting your feedback via telepathy, you know, like in the middle of the day. Don't do that. Use the feedback form.
Send that to me.
Yeah, send that to Big. And preferably look at disturbing porn while sending him the telepathic messages. So, again,
yes.
If the stream goes up and down a little bit during the next week or so, I'm probably working on the back end. I don't expect it to be down for more than a few minutes when I'm messing with it. So, and I'll try to keep an eye on it and make sure I don't mess with it when there's people on it. So, but that's all I've got for tonight. I'm going to hit play on the music. It's Lubbin' Lub by Bonar Pilot.